Russia's invasion of Ukraine set off perhaps the most dangerous struggle between Moscow and NATO allies since the Cold War. Though the two countries share a common history, tensions have dominated relations since Ukraine's 2004 Orange Revolution marked its realignment in the direction of Europe as the country sought to forge closer ties with the European Union and NATO. In a speech days before the assault began, Russian President Vladimir Putin made it clear that he considers Ukraine's place to be within Russia's fold. The resulting invasion, arguably one of the world's gravest security crises since World War II, shows that Putin is determined to settle the matter by force. Welcome to Route 51. I'm Shireen Seward. Today, we seek a better understanding of Russia's war with Ukraine, which so far has resulted in more than 2 million refugees fleeing the country and mounting casualties on both sides of the conflict. As we delve into the history and Western world implications of war, we invite you to join the conversation and ask your own questions of our guests by calling 800-780-9742 or email ideas at WPR.org. The war in Ukraine has the world on edge, creating a significant humanitarian crisis and setting off a ripple effect of economic consequences that reach every part of the globe. Western companies are pulling their business operations out of Russia. President Joe Biden this week announced a ban on Russian energy imports to the U.S. Ukraine's President Zelensky is urging the U.K. Parliament to strengthen sanctions against Moscow and vowed the country will fight till the very end. Today, we welcome two guests to help us understand the history behind the conflict and what it could mean for Western countries and the rest of the world moving forward. Demir Kovacevic is an assistant professor of political science at UW-Eau Claire. He specializes in international relations, international security, and political violence. He primarily teaches courses on world politics, international conflict, and U.S. foreign policy, with research in genocide studies, chemical and biological warfare, and international norms and international law. Professor, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Jeff Lee is a professor of history at UW-Stevens Point. He's also here today. He teaches courses in the history of Russia, modern revolutions, and world wars. His graduate work was in East European history and Russian studies. Professor Lee, welcome to Route 51.
Thank you very much, Shireen.
We are grateful that both of you joined us today to talk about this issue. It is indeed dominating headlines worldwide. It is generating no small amount of fear and confusion. Demir, the biggest question on my mind is, are we headed for world war?
Are we headed for world war? So a question I've been getting the last week or two from students, community members, I don't think we're headed towards world war. And if by world war you mean, will other nations get involved? Will this include major power conflict between Russia, the United States, China? I don't think we're there. And I don't think we will be there. I think this is largely and will continue to be a conflict between Russia and Ukraine. President Biden has made it clear that we will not be involved militarily. NATO and other allies have made this clear. Now, of course, the question that you might be like, the follow-up could be, well, if Russia doesn't stop in Ukraine and goes into Latvia or Poland or Estonia, could this lead to a greater war? In that case, sure. I just don't see that happening. So I see this being a territorial internal struggle in Russia, in Ukraine with Russia, but I don't see it amounting to a world war or a major power battle.
Jeff, why are we here? Why has Russia invaded Ukraine? What is this all about, and what does Putin really want?
Well, you know, Putin, he's a statist first and foremost. If there's anything he believes in, it's the importance of great Russian power. And that he lives in a world wherein great powers vie with one another. This is the old-fashioned imperialist paradigm and the paradigm of the Cold War. Ukraine he sees as a legitimate constituent part of Russia, just as he sees Belarus the same way. In his view, there's one East Slavic people with the Russians, or what they once called themselves, the Great Russians, as the, core or parental figure, and the Ukrainians, or what were once called the Little Russians, and the Bielorussians, or White Russians, as subordinate branches of that single family. He does believe that they all ought to be united and that those countries are not legitimately separate countries, separate peoples, or possessing of separate languages. Now, the degree to which he could ultimately accomplish any kind of reunification is a question of politics on the ground. And that has to do with both internal dynamics and then international dynamics as well. What does he want right now? Well, most recently, he has stated that for a ceasefire, first, the Ukrainians would have to stop shooting back. And second, they would have to commit themselves to demilitarization, not to join NATO, and to accept first the Russian annexation of Crimea, and then the Donbas provinces of Luhansk and Donetsk as independent regions, which, of course, may then be incorporated into Russia.
Does he really think that he can accomplish all of this by force?
I think that he thought that he could. You know, everything we're reading about him and that we can see, of course, dramatically illustrated in his long conference table is that he is a remarkably isolated individual. You know, he is an autocrat within Russia with, I think we could say, pseudo-oligarchs circled around him. You know, these people are no longer the independent players that they used to be in the 1990s. He has sewn up all the levers of power in Russia and much of the mass media, and I don't think he hears much that he doesn't want to hear. I think he does believe, or had believed, that he could send troops into Ukraine, that the Ukrainian people, by and large, would support him. I think he does believe that they think that they're part of a greater Russian nation. I think he thought that he could decapitate the government and put in his own person and perhaps work then toward a unification of the countries. Where he is now is anybody's guess. He has faced more resistance than any of us imagined that he would within Ukraine. He is facing rising levels of resistance within Russia, and he is facing a more united American governmental system under a stronger American president than he had expected, and much greater NATO unity and indeed unity in the international community than he ever dreamed would have been possible.
Demir, Jeff brought up the media and public opinion, and it seems as though there are two wars being fought here, one on the ground and one in the court of public opinion. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov claimed on Thursday that Russia didn't attack Ukraine and is somehow a victim of NATO aggression. The Washington Post this morning pointed out that millions of people in Russia and China have no reason to disbelieve him. Is Putin winning the information war?
He's not winning the information war largely. I don't think he's winning the information war on kind of a grand scale. I think if you look at Western audiences and you look at sort of the united front behind Ukraine, it's very clear, you know, the two sides in this argument, and it's very clear who the evil side is, and it's very clear who the side is to support. So he's not winning in that front. He will win with some Russians in Russia, the disinformation campaign, with sort of the propaganda campaign. It's very easy to do that when you cut off any independent media in the country, or any independent media that did exist has fled the country out of fear. So unfortunately, he will win the information campaign to a degree with Russians. He won't win it with Western Europeans. He won't win it with Americans. And that's been what's, in my opinion, has been very promising, has been seeing that there has been this kind of united message behind Ukraine. And as Jeff mentioned earlier, Putin just sounds delusional, right? He sounds unhinged. He sounds paranoid. And he hasn't sounded like this before. Like, Putin's been around for a long time, and this is new territory for him. And it's scary. But we're not believing it over here, right? He's not convincing us.
Tensions have been building between Russia and Ukraine for years, and I've also read that the roots of the current crisis grew from the breakup of the Soviet Union. Jeff, how did we get here, and is it really tied to the breakup of the Soviet Union?
Well, the breakup of the Soviet Union occurred back in 1991, and you remember at the time that there were already strong independence movements in the Baltic states, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia. There was independence movements operating in the Caucasus. In all 15 of the Soviet republics, including the Russian Federated Republic, there was an increasing desire to dissolve the Soviet Union and each go their own ways. Even, you know, among Russian opinion, that was very strong at the time. Each of the three core Slavic-speaking republics of Belarus, Ukraine, and Russia all declared their independence and then mutually recognized one another's independence. You know, there was an idea they would join together in this coalition of independent states, but that never occurred in the case of Ukraine. They never joined. That began then, and then Russia, of course, having recognized Ukrainian independence, is going to sign treaties with Ukraine repeatedly in the 1990s. Now, Putin claims that those treaties are no longer legitimate because Ukraine is no longer legitimate, and he personally didn't sign them. Now, that's an important thing. States sign treaties with other states, not governments with other governments. And so, you know, he is beholden to those treaties in accordance with international law, but he doesn't feel like he is.
Well, these are terrifying times for Ukrainians. Shells and bombs raining down on their cities. More than 2 million people have fled. How dangerous is this invasion for the rest of Europe? What's the risk there, Dabir?
Well, I guess you could say twofold. The kind of military question is, Ukraine borders eastern flank NATO member states. So if Putin doesn't stop in western Ukraine, does he go into NATO countries, which would be a significant military risk for people on the ground, for those militaries. The second part of that is not necessarily a military question, but it's still a security issue. It's refugee flows. I think the most current numbers are 2 million, 2.5 million. That's significant. You know, those people have to go somewhere. So those people are primarily going to go to Poland first, or they might go to Romania, they might go to Slovakia, they might go to Eastern countries, they might then try to go to Western Europe. Some of them might come to the United States. The refugee crisis, you know, that's a correct term, but it's a security issue. That's a lot of people, and probably the most significant refugee crisis since World War II on the continent, and that's something that we need to pay attention to as well.
We'll be sure to talk a little bit more about that later on in the program as well. I guess, what is NATO saying about all of this? And Jeff, do you think Putin's real beef is with NATO? I mean, what's the problem?
Yeah, Putin definitely carries forward the Cold War idea that was propagated in the Soviet Union, that NATO exists not as a defensive alliance, but as an offensive alliance aimed at Russia, aimed, of course, earlier at the Soviet Union. I think he very much believes that. And so the eastern expansion of NATO, and we'll remember in the early 1990s, there was never a firm promise not to expand NATO eastward. You know, certainly the Russians came away with that feeling, but there was not a firm statement made. And they did sign a treaty in 1997 where NATO clearly stated that they would be expanding eastward and that Russia would accept that. And so we have three ex-Soviet republics, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, and the Warsaw Pact states, you know, on the border of the previous Soviet Union, Poland and Romania, which are our NATO countries. Remember, those countries have traditionally stayed above the 2% threshold of NATO spending, and other countries, including Germany, say we're going to be advancing way past the 2% threshold now. And so he definitely does see NATO as a force that exists to limit Russian ambitions and to limit Russian security. Of course, the NATO position is no, this is an alliance of member states who choose freely to join it for their own interests, and that it is by definition defensive.
You're listening to Jeff Lee and Dabir Kovacevic, our guests today on Route 51, as we discuss the Russian-Ukraine conflict and its worldwide impact. When we return, we'll talk about the potential motivation behind Russian President Vladimir Putin's choice to invade Ukraine, some potential ways the war could end, and we'll answer your questions too when you call us at 800-780-9742. You can also send an email to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. UW Eau Claire Assistant Political Science Professor Dabir Kovacevic and UW Stevens Point History Professor Jeff Lee are with us today to discuss the ongoing crisis and conflict in Ukraine. What would you like to know? Email us at ideas@wpr.org or join us by phone. The number to call is 800-780-9742. There has been a lot of public outcry after the bombing of a hospital in Mariupol and other civilian targets that we're now hearing about. Demir, does that violate the rules of war?
Yes, and clearly. Are we seeing war crimes? I can most likely say yes, we are. When you're fighting war, there are clearly rules of war. International humanitarian law lays that out. And the primary thing we always teach our students, or when we discuss the rules of war, is distinction, right? There has to be a distinction between military targets and civilian targets, and there shouldn't be civilian targets. So when you're clearly bombing a maternity ward, that violates international law. That constitutes war crimes. That constitutes kind of a larger set of crimes we call atrocity crimes. Now, some people have said, could that be genocide? Possibly. That's a little bit more difficult to prove, proving that intent. Genocide cases are very difficult, and they go through international courts of law. But what's clearly happening is that civilians have died in this conflict. We're seeing those atrocity crimes rise.
The latest round of talks ended without an agreement just overnight. Jeff, is there hope for a diplomatic way out of this?
Well, I think there's always hope, and I think you always need to keep diplomacy on the table. There's no reason to stop talking with one another. It, of course, has been rather fruitless. Russia has come forward with evacuation routes that all lead into Russia or into Belarus. And you can understand how Ukrainian citizens and the Ukrainian government are not happy with those as options. The International Red Cross has criticized Russia for violating ceasefires that have been signed in order to be able to bring individual civilians out of the war zones. And that, of course, is disheartening as well. The further this goes forward, I think, the more Putin is going to have to deal with the fact that his military is performing badly and is not likely to start performing better anytime soon. And that this was a badly organized, a badly thought out operation, and that the Russian economy is in horrible shape. The ruble has lost most of its value. The Russian stock market remains closed. There are rationing going on in Russian cities now. Fitch's, which does the international credit ratings, they gave Russia a C rating, not a AAA, a C rating, which means default is imminent. And so as things go forward, Putin is going to have to deal with the fact that his economy is crumbling. And so I think he is going to be the one that needs to negotiate sooner.
Is that kind of change for the Russian people, the Russian way of life, is that enough for them to potentially rise up against Putin? Will that happen, Jeff?
That's one of those things we can't know. Living in Russia, you have to be very careful, especially now with what you say and what you do. But people are taking risks. People are speaking out. They are now doing searches on the streets, stopping people, asking them to check their phones and dragging them away if they're not allowed to check their phones, looking for foreign correspondence, looking for foreign news sources on those phones. That certainly is creating stresses in the country. Hardships are creating stresses. You know, those oligarchs, many of them have their wealth overseas sequestered, as is the wealth of the Russian state. How long that can keep going, you just never know. You know, all revolutions look obvious in hindsight.
Sure.
But they always surprise us when they occur.
Demir, I want to talk a little bit about NATO and then their strategies here. NATO has not approved a no-fly zone over Ukraine. Ukraine's president has been begging for this, but officials from the U.S. and Britain say doing that could result in a longer war, maybe lead to a direct confrontation between NATO and Russia. Is that a valid argument? Why have we not declared the no-fly zone over Ukraine?
Well, and that's very much the reason, Shireen. You know, we've been very clear with the American public. If you think back a couple of weeks ago to the State of the Union address, President Biden made it very clear that this would not be happening. a no-fly zone is, you know, to explain to people that, you know, maybe aren't familiar with the term. I mean, a no-fly zone doesn't just mean Russian airplanes are going to stop flying and then they're just going to respect the airspace. Like, the Russians don't do that. A no-fly zone means we have to be, you know, directly involved militarily, and we have to shoot down those airplanes. So if it's NATO countries shooting down those airplanes, or if it's the United States or whatever it is, Russia is going to see that as an act of war, right? Russia is going to see that as an aggression. They're already blaming the Ukrainians for aggression. They're already blaming the Ukrainians for acts of war and all sorts of, you know, myths that are spewing out of Putin. And so direct Western involvement would only escalate the Russian propaganda machine. It would escalate potentially conflict. And so it's one of those things that I hate to make predictions because I don't know what would happen. But is there a likelihood that a no-fly zone leads to greater conflict amongst more nations? Absolutely.
Jeff, can Ukraine win this war? Is it possible?
Well, you know, the Russian military is much larger than the Ukrainian military, but you're fighting on Ukrainian soil. And so there's much greater motivations. You know, we're getting stories of Russian soldiers who have surrendered who don't understand why they're there. They don't understand why people are shooting at them. They don't know what this is about. They're draftees. You got to remember that. And if you're talking even about the officer class, you know, these are people who by and large would not prefer, it appears, to be in the middle of this thing. The Ukrainians on the other side are highly motivated. And this is one of the interesting things. If we go back to 2010, right, Viktor Yanukovych won the election. Now, there's questions about the second round voting, but he was strongly supported in eastern Ukraine. You are not seeing a pro-Russian popular sentiment even in eastern Ukraine. Russian speakers are also describing themselves as Ukrainian nationals. So what we're seeing is a very strong popular sentiment. We're seeing a president in Zelensky who I would say at this point is the most important political hero in Ukrainian history, all of Ukrainian history. I mean, this guy has risen to the occasion and people are rallying around him. The fact that he stayed in the capital, the fact that he has put his own life at risk when the Americans said, we'll get you out, that's absolutely incredible. As this thing continues forward, as the Russian military moves further in, they become weaker with every mile as the logistic problems grow. And of course, if you get into urban fighting, that's when the differentials in military ability come closer together. You're down to infantry weapons then, and knowing the terrain and being motivated counts for a lot more. The United States fought two unsuccessful insurgencies in the last two decades against a foe who was much less sophisticated than the Ukrainian potentially insurgents, now military forces are. And the United States is far more sophisticated militarily than Russia is. So this differential was greater, and the United States couldn't win against those insurgencies. Here, the difference is closer, and the more Russians get into an occupation situation, the more those actually drop down as well.
Listeners can join the conversation by calling 800-780-9742. Your questions are welcome. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. Demir, I'd like to talk a little bit about sanctions. How do they work, and are they making a difference?
So sanctions are a middle ground before, you know, between diplomacy and warfare. They're an economic, it's not good, economic statecraft tool. And obviously diplomacy with the Russians isn't working, and we don't want to go to war with the Russians. We've been very clear about that, right? There haven't been major power wars since World War II, and we want to avoid those. So you try to cripple countries. You try to put pressure on them with sanctions. Sanctions are all about policy change or regime change. But initially, the sanctions before the February 24th invasion were supposed to be a deterrent. If you remember, we had initial round of sanctions that Biden put in place to deter Putin from acting in the first place because of the military buildup in Belarus and the Ukrainian-Russian border. And then we were all sort of thinking, okay, well, Putin's waiting for the Olympics to be over, and then he's going to make his move right out of respect for China. Then the sanctions ramped up and ramped up and ramped up and ramped up. But what also happened was that they're in coordination with other Western allies, right? It was a concerted multilateral effort. And so the kind of sanctions that we're seeing in Russia today are sort of unprecedented. Like, we haven't hit a major country like this in a sort of concerted effort. You know, it's unspeakable. And as Jeff mentioned earlier, it's left the economy in shambles. It's affected oligarchs. It's affected Putin. It's affected Russia. Russia is stating, but it's affected everyday people. You try not to usually do that with sanctions, right? You try to target sanctions to specific individuals, specific sectors. But we've ramped them up in a way, right now moving from the deterrent category to maybe a compellence category, right? Compel Putin to stop what he's doing. But that in return has hurt everyday Russian people. So have they worked? I mean, yeah, they've weakened the Russian economy. They've devastated the country. Major businesses are just opting out of Russia, right? So it's a sanctions regime and a private business response. Will it lead ultimately to Putin standing down? I don't know. Will it lead to, you know, Ukraine winning this war? I don't know. But it has put significant pressure on Russia, and we're seeing that.
Demir brought up China, and Jeff, I'd like your thoughts on this. What is China's role in all of this, and do you think China could do more to stop this war?
Yeah, you remember a couple of weeks ago when China and Russia announced that memorandum, essentially saying that they're both in opposition to the expansion of U.S. power globally and the expansion of NATO territorially. You remember also in that memorandum that there was no mention of Ukraine, that China did not want that, you know, specifically brought into the question. China still remains today opposed to those NATO expansion or the growth of U.S. power internationally, because, of course, it interferes with Chinese interests with regard to Taiwan and, of course, Chinese treatment of the Uyghurs within China itself. And so they definitely want to hold it off. Now, China has also expressed sympathy for the Ukrainians. Interesting, the same voice, the same moment they try to say, well, but this is the U.S.'s fault or this is NATO's fault. But they really don't have an argument there. China doesn't want to get drawn into this. I can't see China willing to sacrifice anything for the benefit of Russia and Vladimir Putin. China would like to be seen as a third force out there, and they've actually offered to mediate the dispute. Now, how much Russia is willing to accept that, who knows, but it's probably a more acceptable option for a mediator than, say, Turkey, who has also made the same promise.
Interesting. The world was on edge when the nuclear power plant was hit. That really set off alarm bells for so many people. Demir, what are the risks to Ukraine, to Europe, or even more broadly, the planet, if nuclear plants in Ukraine are attacked and melt down?
Well, to Ukraine, they've shut off power before in Ukraine, and so that the risk there is very immediate to everyday Ukrainians who are living there, who will freeze, who are running out of food. I think it triggers a kind of emotional response from all of us, because we think of Chernobyl, we think of 1986, we think of 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis, right? We think of the magnitude of these weapons. I mean, saying nuclear warfare is a scary thing. These weapons exist. 95% of these weapons exist in Russia and the United States, Russia having the most. Putin has used language rooted in nuclear warfare as kind of a deterrent to essentially tell the West, right, don't come into this. Would he ever turn to those weapons? No, I don't think so. I think there's a very strong case to make that, you know, I think there's a nuclear taboo. I think that's very obvious. But it's not comforting to hear that kind of language. I think for a lot of us that, you know, maybe we're alive, Cold War, study the Cold War and understand that time, this was a very significant and real threat. And it's something that we've kind of put in the background a lot. And it's kind of coming up again. So like 2022 feels like, you know, 1962 or, you know, 1945. And I think that's frightening for people.
We've heard Putin call the Ukrainian government a Nazi regime. Jeff, what does he mean by that?
Well, this is part of the old Soviet vocabulary, right? That World War II is a struggle against the Nazis. World War II is a struggle against fascism. Anything on the, well, in the Soviet view, on the right wing, which would mean most of the spectrum internationally for them, was called routinely as fascist. In the Soviet Union, then later in Russia, and to some degree, you know, Ukraine and the other republic as well, you know, this is a living memory still of having to fight back against an invasion by people who called themselves Nazis. It I think rings much more strongly there than even communism does in the United States. And we know that is still a strong propaganda ploy here. So it's a term that rings in the ears of people hearing Putin's propaganda. So it's not, you know, it's not mere words, and it's not just a historical reference. It does, I think, still have a strong resonance. Now, applying it to Ukraine today is, with the Jewish president, nonetheless, is an absolutely ridiculous statement. That doesn't mean that people watching the Russian right nightly news, remember, that's the older generation, that it doesn't reflect their thinking. We have people, Russian citizens living in Ukraine, talking to their families back in Russia, explaining to them what's going on, and their older generations back in Russia don't believe it. You know, they believe the propaganda. I think among younger Russians, it doesn't fly, though.
Since the war began, there's been a lot of support for Ukraine by the American people, largely. But let's be honest, these gas prices at, you know, $4 or $5 a gallon, they're not going over well. Demir, do you think that Americans will continue to support the Ukrainian effort, even if it's hurting them in the pocketbook?
Yeah, it was interesting to see. You know, you look at recent polling, the amount of Americans that supported sanctions on Russian oil was overwhelmingly, I think, about 70%. And so I think Americans early on have said, we are willing to swallow the short-term costs. I mean, it's been happening. We know the president has been very direct about it. This is going to continue to happen. The longer this drags out, even if this isn't a war that we're fighting, people build up war fatigue. They don't want this to drag out anymore. And yes, they will start considering their own self-interest. They will start considering their own situations at home. That's unfortunately how it is. So people will look at rising gas prices and eventually say, this has got to stop. Now, they won't necessarily blame the Ukrainians for that. They'll look for someone to blame, and hopefully we're all going to blame Putin for it. But eventually, if this does go on longer, it hurts everyone. It hurts Putin. It hurts the Ukrainian people, right? It doesn't work out for anyone. So you're hoping that it doesn't drag on. The longer it does drag on, you will see more dissatisfaction with the American people, in my opinion.
You're listening to Demir Kovacevic and Jeff Lee, our guests today on Route 51, as we take a deep dive into Russia's war with Ukraine and its potential consequences on people like us who live far away from the conflict but are still seeing widespread impact. We'd like to hear from you, too. You can join us by calling 800-780-9742 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Our guests today are Jeff Lee and Demir Kovacevic, both experts on Russian history and the politics of war, for a discussion on the ongoing conflict in Ukraine. What would you like to know? Email us at ideas@wpr.org or join us by phone. The number to call is 800-780-9742. We did have an email from a listener who says he is very concerned about how much money and weaponry the U.S. has provided to militia groups in Ukraine since 2015 after the annexation of Crimea. He says the media is not addressing the possible ramifications of supporting extremist groups to fight against Russia. I'm not sure which one of you would be better to answer that question. Jeff, what about you?
I mean, it is problematic. There is the Azov Battalion, right, which is about 2,500 individuals as of last count. In the 2014 or beginning in the 2014 conflict, a lot of civilian militias arose. And among those were some with extreme nationalistic sentiments. And some of that goes back, you know, decades and decades and decades. Ukraine, like every country in the world, has some of this going on. You remember, over the last 2 years, both the German military and the United States military became increasingly concerned with white supremacist concepts among their members. And remember, with the insurrection, quite a bit of those people had U.S. military backgrounds. So that kind of thing does exist out there. And absolutely, as we saw in Afghanistan during the 1980s, you have no control over where weapons go after you've put them into somebody's hands. So that's a concern. I think on the part of the Ukrainian government, that's very much a secondary issue at this moment. The most important issue is actually being invaded and having, as was discussed earlier, human rights violations conducted against your own people. These relatively small groups of people, I think, are really a secondary issue, and that can be dealt with after peace has been restored.
Ukrainian and Russian officials have tentatively agreed on the need for humanitarian corridors, basically the safe zones for civilians to flee and supplies to pass through. We keep hearing about it, but then we keep hearing multiple reports about Russian shelling in those areas. Is there a safe way for people who want to get out, Demir?
Well, a safe way would be for a ceasefire. A safe way would be for this conflict to stop. A safe way would be a ceasefire longer than a few hours, longer than a day. It would be one that the Russians respect. It would be one that the Ukrainians could expect the Russians to hold up. Unfortunately, we haven't seen that, right? We've seen these, you know, humanitarian routes in place that have been essentially then been shelled. So, I mean, if I'm looking for a solution, it's ceasefire is your most immediate solution. The solution, honestly, is, you know, this stops. It's still going to lead to refugee flows. You have to address refugee flows. But then the greater question there is, well, what are the Ukrainian and Russian governments bargain on? And eventually, what is the diplomatic solution to all of this? That's sort of how I see it. But unfortunately, that hasn't been the case.
You talked about the humanitarian crisis earlier in the program. And Jeff, I'd like your take on this. We know more than 2 million people have already fled. Many of them are in Poland. Some are going to other countries. How is the world going to address their needs? How is the world going to care for these people who have lost their homes?
Right. The response has already been strong and very positive. We have a $14 billion bill that just made it through Congress yesterday and is scheduled to arrive today on the president's desk. A lot of that is humanitarian aid. The Europeans certainly have stepped up, and individual Europeans have driven all the way from Western Europe down to Poland, Slovakia, Romania to try to help out with the refugees. People are taking them into their own homes. Restaurants are opening up to them. There's been a tremendous amount of sympathy expressed. Now, there becomes a limit, ultimately, to how much these societies are willing to accept and help pay for refugees. So there's, you know, just as there's a war weariness that sets in, there's certainly a refugee resettlement weariness that will set in as well. So far, though, there's been an absolutely strong positive response to try to help these people.
The number to call is 800-780-9742. If you have questions, you're welcome to join. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Demir, are both sides taking prisoners of war? I haven't heard a whole lot about that.
Well, there have been, I've heard a little bit, I guess I could say. I mean, there have been captured prisoners on both sides. You've heard stories of prisoners being able to call back home and talk to family, talk to mothers and fathers. I think what's been interesting for me from this question, I've been thinking about this one a lot, actually, talking to my students about this, is we're seeing 21st century war unfold, and we're seeing it unfold in a way where everyone involved, whether you're a spectator, whether you're a belligerent at the tactical level, the strategic level, everyone is glued to what's happening. Everyone has access to phones. Everyone has contacts, and everyone is able in real time to get a hold of people. And so hearing stories of prisoners being captured and then being able to phone home, that's kind of like the devastating human toll that you get out of it. It's a different type of story from, you think of warfare in the 19th or 20th centuries where, you know, you go off to war and then it's like, okay, maybe we'll hear from you. Maybe we won't, unfortunately. In this case, you know, you're seeing kind of that being reported. Fascinating story for me. I don't know if, Jeff, you have like numbers on that, but I don't know, like, in terms of what either side has sort of captured in terms of prisoners of war.
The only thing that I've seen on that is from about a week ago, the Russian Ministry of Defense said that they had about 500 killed, 600 captured, 1,500 wounded. Since that time, of course, the United States has estimated very broadly 2,000 to 4,000 killed. The Ukrainians say, no, we killed 12,000 of them, We don't know. I haven't heard any stories specifically talking about Russians having captured Ukrainians, although that must have happened. On the Ukrainian side, we get a lot of videos out where captured soldiers are shown and shown in, you know, rather humiliated situations, which is, you know, which is problematic in international law as well. But certainly there are a lot of Russians who have been captured. But that's the only information that we're getting out or that I've been able to find so far.
Jeff, tell us a little bit more about the cultural situation in Ukraine. What ties exist with Russia, what with the West? I'm thinking about people who have family in both countries, some regions being pro-Russia, others are pro-NATO. How do they navigate that?
Well, it's difficult. You know, remember that, you know, in the Soviet Union, we had a Moscow-centered regime that ruled over Ukraine and ruled over, of course, all the various regions of the Soviet Union, sometimes promoting the idea that these regions need to have their cultural existence highlighted, sometimes clamping down on those expressions. There was also a program to move Russian speakers into various areas of the Soviet Union to create facts on the ground. You remember all the Russians that lived in the Baltic states. There were Russians moved increasingly into the Ukraine. In fact, in 1958, when parents in the Ukraine were given the right to choose whether their students, whether their children be educated in Russian and Ukrainian, the overwhelming majority chose Russian. Now, they did that not out of a national sentiment one way or the other, but that they thought that would bring more opportunities to their students. You know, there are a lot of international schools around the world that teach in English, of course, and that's because the parents believe that that's going to be the greatest set of opportunities available then for their children. In the 2010 elections, again, you had a strong Eastern Ukraine sentiment encouraging a pro-Russian orientation to Ukrainian foreign policy and Ukrainian trade. 2014, with the, you could say the second revolution, 2008 being the first and 2014 being the second, and then the subsequent Russian invasion of the Donbas and of Crimea, sentiment has turned extremely far towards supporting a Western orientation and away from a Russian orientation. Remember the 2019 elections, it was a total sweep against the movement towards a Russian orientation. And so Putin has really created facts on the ground contrary to his own interest in Ukraine. At the same time, there's still a lot of families who have connections in both places. And of course, they're in a very difficult spot.
Demir, how has the U.S.'s approach to foreign policy with Russia contributed to this situation? Or doesn't that play a role?
Yeah, it plays a role. I mean, if you listen to Russia throughout the years, and we mentioned this earlier in the program, they would blame it on NATO expansion. They would blame it on U.S. hegemony. They would blame it on, you know, Western influence in the region. If you think of, like, you actually picture the map in your head right now, you think of the European continent. Ukraine is literally the last thing standing in the way of a NATO border pushing up on Russia, right? I mean, Ukraine and Belarus in a way. And so Russians, since the 90s, have been saying that, you know, we lied to them, that we said we wouldn't expand, although we did, and we said that that's not the case. Bringing in Eastern flank countries starting in 2004 and onward, I think, was a significant move. But I think the greater implications is one where you're seeing kind of, if you look at in international relations, we have a term called polarity. So you're looking at bipolar, unipolar, multipolar systems. We've been in kind of a unipolar moment since the end of the Cold War. And the Soviets recognize that, right? They recognize the weakening of the Soviet Union because now it's just Russia. They see that they're no longer the one of, you know, two of equals, right? And but they also see a rising Russia, or excuse me, a rising China. So if anything, if we're in a bipolar kind of contest with China and the United States, and the Russians want to be in on that, they know they want to be in on that, right? They're opposed to that kind of Western liberal international order, but they're going to find their own narrative to blame for that, right? They're going to blame NATO for that. They're going to blame, you know, U.S. presidential decision making on that. But in a lot of ways, it's kind of the clear balance of power politics that we're seeing, not to the degree of the Cold War, because Russia isn't the Soviet Union. I think they might think they want to be, or they might think of themselves that way. But we're definitely kind of getting to that point with Putin's behavior, his actions, and, you know, the steps that he's taken in Ukraine.
I'm curious, Jeff, how much of a potential economic catastrophe is this for the world as the war rages on? how much are we going to see this hurt?
Yeah, the longer it goes, the worse it is. And the people, of course, who are suffering the most right now are obviously the Ukrainians. There's a question about whether you're going to be able to do spring planting after all. That's very important. The Russians, of course, are suffering tremendously as well. Russian fuel resources, what is it? Their petroleum exports are, what, about 10% of global petroleum trades. About 25% for Europe, about 3% for the United States. In the United States case, and maybe in the global case, you can say, okay, look, we can increase drilling. You know, the United States has increased oil production over the last year. That definitely has happened. There's a lot of unused leases in the United States, places the oil companies could be drilling today that they have chosen not to drill in. You could certainly change the sanction regime against Venezuela and Iran if you found that to be necessary. There's ways to counteract, including the increase, as we've been seeing in Europe and increasingly in the last 2 weeks, of calls for more and more renewables. Those are ways to get out from under this as well. So there's things that you can do to mitigate some of the losses. There are strategic minerals in Russia and Ukraine. You know, that's going to be an issue. And grain exports, of course, are very important from those two countries as well. And so you would have to find alternatives. And those have got to be put into place pretty quickly as we're starting to get towards spring planting in many places in the Northern Hemisphere.
Demir, how does this all end? What are we looking at? Yeah. A long war? Are we looking at a short war? What do you think?
Depends on what you consider a short and long war. We're not looking at a years long war, I hope. And you know, we're 2 weeks into it, and it's been long for us, right? It's been too long. How does it all end? I mean, if we're laying out the realistic options, one way it ends is Putin keeps fighting the war. He keeps losing the PR campaign, and I mean, obviously, Russian soldiers will die. But he ultimately gets what he wants by installing a puppet regime, maybe getting the Donbas region, keeping the Donbas region, keeping Crimea, getting a more pro-Russian leaning Ukraine. That could happen. The other way it ends is Ukraine keeps resisting as they have, which has just been spectacular. Putin finally realizes he has to make some kind of diplomatic concession. And what that probably means for the Ukrainians, and this is something that they've stood down on now, is we're not going to join NATO. Like, we have to maybe accept the fact that we will not become a NATO member. What I'm not as certain about is, if it does come to a diplomatic end, which we hope it does soon, what happens to the Donbas region and Crimea, right? Do you rightfully just, or do you just say, okay, Russia, you can have it. Like, we're not going to fight you on this. Will this prevent you from doing this in the future? That's something that I'm less clear about. So, hate to make predictions, because this is a very significant event. But my prediction is it won't be a long war. Right? We're not looking at years here.
We've got about a minute and a half left, and I want to ask this. There has been talk and fear that another Iron Curtain is about to fall. Are we looking at another Cold War? Jeff, what are your thoughts?
Well, in a sense, one has already fallen as Putin has separated Russia from the rest of the world. Remember, you know, this is entirely a war of choice on the part of Vladimir Putin. There's no reason other than his ambitions for this war to have ever occurred in the first place. And so the only way it stops is with him stopping the war, because right now it's not imaginable that the Ukrainians are going to give up. So Russia has separated itself now from the world under Vladimir Putin. Of course, no more Vladimir Putin running Russia. Everything, of course, can change. The question ultimately is how much would it take for him to be willing to stop the war? How could he possibly see this as a victory at this point and end hostilities?
In our final 30 seconds, Demir, I'd like your thoughts on that, too. Are we looking at another Cold War? Is this where we're headed?
I don't think we're headed to the degree of a 45, 50 year type of Cold War. But the language, the hostilities, sort of the standoff between the West and Russia, it definitely feels like that. It definitely feels like a Cold War 2.0. That's my best guess on that.
Thank you so much. That's all we have time for today on Route 51. I'm Shireen Seward. I would like to thank our guests one more time, Demir Kovacevic and Jeff Lee. Our producers are Joy Ratch-Kramer and Kate Spranger. Our executive producer is Rick Ryer. Rick is also our on-air producer today. Special music today from Roman Senek, John Brooks, Yi Lo, and Morning Light. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. You can hear the archive of today's program, as well as our previous programs, at wpr.org/route51. If you have an idea for a future program, email us at ideas@wpr.com. We would love to hear from you. Next week, we'll be back with another discussion, and we hope you join us. Until then, we're headed out of town.